Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the officially unofficial Def Leppard podcast, Def Leppard Pod. Today we are here to talk about the 1989 BBC documentary Rock of Ages, The Def Leppard Story. And joining me are my rock music brothers from other mothers, Mac and Action, from the wonderful, the absolutely wonderful Ugly American Werewolf in London podcast. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. And how are you today?
Doing real well. Thanks so much for having us, Neil.
Yeah, great, Neil. Great to see you and hear from you again.
You two are very much at the core of why this episode is happening. And I'm going to talk a little bit more in a moment about some really like personal reasons why I've been wanting to do an episode on this particular documentary for a really, really long time. And I've just been waiting for the right opportunity. And it was you two gentlemen that actually provided the opportunity and provided the idea. So to kick us off, the idea to do this with you two in particular came after I appeared on your podcast and we discussed another music documentary. And people hear me talk all the time. So could maybe you just start off by telling us what exactly we did on that episode?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no. So, you know, Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast is about my experience as an expat living in the UK and then trying to show some of the differences between being a UK rock fan versus a US rock fan. And the band that you love is a glaring example about how a band might make it in one place, but maybe not do quite so well in another. And at the end of the year there, I think everyone in rock and roll, whether they were your favorite band or not, when the Get Back documentary came out and was available, everyone flocked to this thing, right? Everyone wanted to see what were the Beatles really like 50 years ago when they were kind of getting ready to break up and about to do their final concert on the row, on Savile Row and all that kind of stuff. And the documentary was fascinating, right? But it's a lot to take in. So I'm like, well, we've got to review it. And Action and I can do that. But we wanted to have the English take on it. And I said, well, we've got our buddy Neil. And he's from Liverpool, where the lads are from. So none of us were huge Beatles fans necessarily, but we're rock fans and there's a lot of information. So I figure let's do it together and get the English perspective as well as the US perspective. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, the time always flies by with you, Neil. You know your stuff and it's fun talking with you.
And I think, too, it was interesting to get your take. Because you grew up, I mean, we grew up with it in the United States. I mean, my parents had one or two Beatles records. I know Mac's parents listened to it here and there, but you were every day, you were inundated with Beatles, everything. So yeah, that's, we really wanted to get your take, not even so much as a fan, but somebody who was exposed day in and day out. You know, you said there was a Yellow Submarine playscape or something at the school, and everybody said that the Beatles were the greatest band ever. Yeah, just to get your take on it.
And it's interesting there that you say about the idea of being exposed to something, because that is part of why I wanted you two to come on, because you have got that experience of Def Leppard in the States in the mid to late 80s, where, and we've discussed this before, where you literally couldn't avoid them. They were absolutely everywhere. Like everywhere you went, Def Leppard were there. And that was something that we've never really had in the UK. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting about our conversation on the Get Back documentary by the Beatles, which obviously was like a big 8 or 9 hour epic. Mm-hmm. And the documentary we're going to be discussing today, I mean, a lot of people don't even know it exists, and you can just find a ropey old copy of it on YouTube. But it's all a little bit grainy. But what was really interesting and what sort of sparked the idea for this was that none of us are huge Beatles fans. We've got a respect for the Beatles, and you know, we might like some of the songs and some of the albums, but we're not like diehard Beatles fans. And that gave it a really good take. And that tip brings us on to this episode and what we're doing today, the 1989 documentary Rock of Ages, The Def Leppard Story. Because what I was always going to do is what we normally do. I was going to get Def Leppard fans on, like diehard Def Leppard fans who love everything in their career, sure, and have a retrospective of this documentary. But I thought what would be much more interesting is, I know that you two like Def Leppard to an extent and a part of their career, but not all of it. And I thought, you know what would be much more interesting is to get the opinions and insights of someone or two people, yourselves, who are seeing it for the very, very first time and haven't got this relationship with it. Because this came out in 1989. It was aired on the BBC in July, August 1989. Now, normally I have exact dates. I haven't got any dates for this. This is all from my memory. I'm getting on a little bit now, so I can't guarantee that all of this is spot on, but I'm pretty certain it is. And I know for a fact that it was the summer, because I remember seeing it when it was aired originally, and I was in a caravan in North Wales on holiday. A lot of people from Liverpool, fellas, we go on holiday to North Wales because it's only about, you know, an hour away, right. But it's nicer. So we were in a caravan there, and I remember watching it for the first time, and I can, to this day, I can picture me watching it as an 11-year-old on the television in the caravan. That was the first time I saw it. And then the second time I saw it was about 6 months later. And that Christmas period, over the Christmas period and the New Year, do you remember there was a lady called Elvira, like in the 80s and 90s, and she was like a sort of vampire-looking woman-type rock horror.
She's still around, and she amazingly looks not that different. I guess if you never go in the sun, it helps.
Well, here, what happened is on the BBC over that Christmas period, they had like a package for about 10 days or 2 weeks, but every night they had a rock documentary on or a heavy metal documentary, and it was absolutely brilliant. And she would do like a little 5-minute section at the start of each one that she's obviously pre-recorded, introducing it. And then there'd be a different heavy metal or rock music documentary on over that time. And in Britain, we have something called the Radio Times, something called the TV Times. And it's very much a tradition that at Christmas, you would buy it and it would give you all of the television listens as well as the radio listens. And you get your red pen and you circle all of the cool films and all the cool things that are on over Christmas. And I had circled, and I haven't got any more, but I swear this is the date. On the 3rd of January, 1990, this was repeated, this documentary. And I remember waiting up. This was all really like late at night as well. This was like, you know, at midnight, this sort of stuff would be on. And I remember staying up as an 11-year-old to watch it again for the second time. But this time I had my video recorder and I taped it. And it went on to my Def Leppard video with all like little bits and things that I'd taped off the telly. So that's when it came out in Britain. That's my sort of history with it. So I've lived with this for 30 years. I'm not really interested in what I think about it. What I'm really interested in is what you two think about it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rip off entirely what we did on your Get Back episode with the Beatles, where we just went through some highlights and takeaways and just gives us a route in to talk about it really however we want. Now, just to let you know, I have got 5 takeaways or highlights, but I'm probably not going to mention mine. What I want is yours, really. So that's what we'll do. That's what we'll crack on with. And action, I think we're going to start with you, okay, is you've seen this. You've seen it for the first time. What's your first general views or your first highlights or takeaway from watching it?
There was some stuff in there that I knew, and there was some stuff that I didn't know. Just kind of about, I mean, because this goes from the beginning of the band up until 1989. So after Hysteria, they had already done that. So the big takeaways is that they were really, really young when they started. Just, I mean, unbelievably, like just children.
Kids.
And so that was just the energy that they had as these kids who were going to make it. I think we kind of forget in the United States that they were giant. They were this giant band, especially with Hysteria. They really took over for that. And they kind of, I don't know, like in the United States, we had like Motley Crue, and they were always known as these, you know, basically these scumbag, you know, they were rock and rollers, but they, you know, they lived the lifestyle. They were, you know, passed out on the street and everything. And Def Leppard kind of flew under the radar as far as that. I mean, they were always kind of like the, you know, like the nice guys, the good guys, but they did some pretty heavy duty partying, and they were just a really big band, and you can't take that away from them. That's the thing to me, is you really don't get the scope of how big they really were. And I think this documentary did a pretty good job. So my takeaways were, the fact that they were really young, the Mutt Lang angle about how much he really just shaped the sound of them. I forgot that he had done High and Dry also. I knew he did Pyromania and I knew he did Hysteria, but that was kind of the lead up when they were on MTV in 1983, which is when I caught up with them. I didn't know anything about them until they hit with the videos Fooling, Photograph, and Rock of Ages. But apparently at that time, there was some heat from High and Dry also on rock radio, which I mean, I didn't listen to at that point in time. I was still too young to figure that out. So that was big for me too, just to hear Mutt Lang talk about the fact that, okay, listen, kids, don't fall in love with the songs that you bring in, because they're not anywhere close to being perfect. When we get them done, they are going to be perfect, and I'm going to teach you how to write songs, like great classic songs. The other thing for me too was the In the Round show. That was way ahead of its time. Like when you think about, I mean, that was what they did.
So
then.
Cool too.
Yeah, and we didn't see that. We saw on the Adrenalized tour, so that was kind of like it wasn't exactly the same, but it was pretty close. Yeah, it was just an experience. And then a couple other people like Metallica, I know, pretty much ripped that off.
In the round.
Stage setup. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it was just an experience to see them do that, just to get that close to the band.
You've touched on loads of things there, so
yeah. So maybe we should stop for a minute and take that all in.
No, there's loads of things there. I mean, let's talk about the Mutt Lang thing first. Okay. Because have you ever seen an interview with Mutt Lang before?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Mutt. He's kind of a snow leopard, right? He is camera shy. He doesn't do that. Even once he took over Shania Twain's career, and she's this huge thing in the U.S., you never saw him. You never heard him. He's only done like 3 or 4 interviews, and one or two of them are captured, you know, for this, you know. So, and, you know, he is South African, but he doesn't really have a strong South African accent. No. You know, you would probably think he was English just by listening to him speak a paragraph or whatever there. But he's obviously a task master. And I remember I listened to your show when you reviewed the ill-fated VH1 movie about Hysteria, the Def Leppard story. And Anthony Michael Hall, who you said, well, nobody in this movie was ever anything else. Well, Anthony Michael Hall was a pretty big star. You know, he was in the original Vacation. He was in all those John Hughes, you know, 16 Candles Breakfast Club movies, and was even in a Batman movie. So he continues to work. But you were complaining, he doesn't have a South African accent. I'm like, yeah, but nobody knows that. Yeah. Nobody knows what Mutt Lang sounds like. You know, he doesn't talk to anybody.
I'm very pedantic, Mac. I complain about lots of things. I don't matter to anybody else. That's what I do. Well, that's what I've always thought really good about one of the things that's really good about this this documentary is that you do get these rare interviews and rare chances to listen to people that you've never really heard from before. Because it's interesting, if you see any other Def Leppard documentaries that have come out since. So Def Leppard were obviously behind this because Joe Elliott actually presents it, and you know, they've got a lot of involvement, and there's, you know, all of the managers are in it, and like, you know, there's lots of people really steeped in the Def Leppard story in it. So you can see that they're very much involved. It's not something that is being done away from them at arm's length. And if you see any other Def Leppard documentaries since, a lot of them will take footage from this documentary.
Yep.
And pretty much the only clip I've ever seen of Mutt Lang talking ever is from this documentary. And how do you think he comes across in it? Does he come across like this mythical figure that we hear of in like Def Leppard world, in terms of like, you know, the perfectionist or the guru or the mentor? He has all of these sorts of different parts to his character that we hear about. Do you think that comes across at all in the actual documentary?
Mentor, yes. I feel like the mentor part comes through. The taskmaster, I mean, he seems like a pretty good guy. He seems like the kind of guy you like to sit down and have a pint and discuss what you want to do, and then, you know, go figure out and start to do it. But it's hard to convey a workaholic or a domineering guy in an interview like that. He doesn't seem like the guy who would sit on your shoulder and say, do it again, do it again, do it again. But apparently that is what he is. And you know, maybe he's very different while working versus while being social. And, you know, I think a lot of people are like that. You can be very convivial and friendly and things like that. But when it's work time, it's like, look, we're here to do a job, fellas. And this isn't playtime. You don't come here drunk. You know, you don't do it once and say that's good enough. You get it right on tape. There's no fix it in the mix thing here. But I mean, he seems serious, but he didn't seem like a hard ass. He seemed like a pretty decent guy.
I was going to say, but I think the thing too about him is that he's got the hardware to back it up. I mean, to me, it just kind of seemed like if you work with me, you're going to sell a lot of records, but you're going to do it my way. So it's up to you. They all seemed like they were very excited to work with him. In fact, there was one point where they were talking about hiring Phil Collins or thinking about hiring him. And they said, just bring him to Mutt, see if he can play. And if he gives him the thumbs up, then he's in. But, you know, real quick, too, you were talking about the other people. It was nice to see Pete Willis in there and to give his part of the story, which I thought was a little hinky. Yeah, but that's OK, because they talked about him coming in drunk to the recording studio. And, you know, he couldn't show up. He was getting to be undependable. But my thing was they ran into all of that with Steve Clark. But it seemed like they gave Steve Clark a much wider berth. They were kind of like, hey, Pete, this isn't working out, so we need to get rid of you. So I think they thought, or they knew what he was all about. He wasn't the guy that was going to bring them to the next level. He just didn't have the goods. He didn't have the vision. He didn't really want to do what was necessary to take them to the next level. And so they found Phil Collins.
And he didn't have the look either. He's short and dark haired and, you know, Steve Clark's good looking and blonde and, you know, and then you get Phil and everybody's blonde and it makes sense visually. And they'll even admit, I think in this, like 50% of it was how you looked, certainly at the beginning in 1977 or whatever. And then we'll figure out the music part later. Now, obviously, when Phil comes in, he's pretty polished at this point. We need a professional, somebody who's good at that point. But you also had to look the part, too. That's especially in the MTV era. That's very important.
Well, the nice thing for Pete was, too, that it seemed like he was at a good place in 1989. I think he was some kind of production thing. And I think he realized, yeah, that wasn't for me. I wasn't going to do this. And I think they did give him a full share of the Pyromania record, so that I'm sure was not too tough to take, seeing those checks roll in.
Yeah, it's a quite good, actually, the way this is edited, this documentary, because what often happens is you'll see one person talking, so you'll see Pete Willis talking, for example, and you'll be talking about how he's got on, you know, ever since he left Def Leppard in 1989. Well, how he was feeling at that point in 1989 and how he's got on since. And then all of a sudden it'll cut to like Peter Mention, like New York or somewhere, saying Pete Willis was fine. He got loads of royalties for Pyromania. We've looked after him. And there's lots of things like that where you'll see one bit of footage from, there's a bit, for example, with the managers, the very, very first managers that they had, Frank Stewart Brown and Pete Martin, I think were the names, where Frank Stewart Brown is talking about when they sacked him as managers, and On Through the Night comes out. And then when they looked at the credits for On Through the Night and all of the thank yous, there was no mention of Pete and Frank and how like that hurt his feelings. And then all of a sudden it just cuts to Joe, and Joe says, well, we were that pissed off by the time we got to that point that we weren't really in the mood for thanking them. The way it's edited puts like a little bit of drama where they're obviously not in the same room talking to each other, but they get to respond, or mostly Def Leppard or Def Leppard's management get to respond to other things that other people are saying.
I was going to say, I would have loved to have seen the outtakes from Peter Martin, because you could tell he was just chewing on nails when he was talking about that. Like, he was like, well, you know, I'd have done the same thing. It's a, you know, dog eat dog business or whatever, but you know, he just was so upset about this whole, about getting just steamrolled by the guys in New York, but that's the business.
I'd never seen Pete Martin or Frank Stewart Brown before. Yeah. So I thought it was good that they had them in there. But yeah, I mean, it was also like these guys kind of have the also-ran look on their faces, you know, like, you know, Pete Martin said, yeah, well, we had a blow up about, you know, someone puked out the van and I made somebody clean it up and they didn't want to. And Joe and I came to blows. He's like, and that's when I knew we would probably have to move on from, like, Is that a little hindsight, pal? Because if you've got a big piece of gold, you're not going to just say, okay, can I trade this in for, you know, a few shillings or whatever. It's like, no, you're going to make it work no matter how big of a pain it is. And you're right, Jackson. You know, look, if you've got a League Two team, then the manager that you've got to League Two to maybe get you to League One once in a while is different than a Premier League manager. That's just the bottom line. And, you know, if you want to get to the Premier League, the guy you've got in League Two right now, he's not going to get you there, right? And that's the bottom line. You know, America was the big leagues, especially for Hard Rock in the 80s. You got five times the population. And yeah, I mean, those guys at Q Prime, you know, they're going to work with AC/DC. They're working with Metallica. You could see Peter Mensch wearing his And Justice for All tour jacket during that interview, you know. So getting them, that's, you know, it's the big league. We're working with the New Yorkers. That's the big leagues, you know. And they were kind of like, oh, David Krebs did the same thing to AC/DC's management, Australian management the year before. I'm like, yeah. And then they made Back in Black and they became the biggest thing ever. So was it a bad thing? It's just, it's a little sour grapes, but it was good to have them in there because I had not seen them and didn't know that story.
And that was another thing that came through to me about Joe Elliott is that he comes off and I've never met him, but he's probably a nice guy in real life, but he's not fooling around. He knows what he wants. He's not going to accept anything less. And so, yeah, I'm sure once he met the Q Prime guys, they knew these are the guys, like you said, Mac, these are the Premier League guys. This is what we need to take us to the next level.
Yeah, and you get that because every band has the driving force behind them. So if it's Iron Maiden, it's, you know, Steve Harris. If it's AC/DC, it's, you know, it's Angus and Malcolm Young. And, you know, everyone has the driving force. And in this documentary, it's clear that Joe Elliott is the driving force. What's really interesting, though, you see the bit with Rick Allen in his lovely pink leather jacket, where he's really proud about him. He's really proud about his involvement in getting Peter Mensch and Cliff Bernstein to become the managers, where he actually says, on like a backstage show, I think it's when they're supporting AC/DC, when he says, come over here and listen to what our two managers are talking about at the moment. So just listen to how clueless they are. Like Peter Mensch has a listening and he doesn't want to get involved, but he's like, yeah, these are bad. So I think Rick Allen says it about how he's, you know, he's happy that he played quite a role in, you know, making that management change. The thing about bad managers in British metal in the early 80s is that there's loads and loads of stories. I won't go into it now, but my favourite one, and it's a band from that era, is Diamond Head, who were like part of the new wave of British heavy metal. And they were up there and they were supposed to be one of the ones who could like really make it. They were like, you know, they were like Def Leppard and Iron Maiden. There's one of the ones who couldn't make it. I reckon one of the reasons that they never made it was because they never changed their manager. And the reason they never changed their manager was because, I don't know if it's the guitarist or the singer, but their mum was the manager and they didn't want to upset their mum by sacking her and taking the job off her. And then obviously they never actually made it at all. But no, good stuff. So Matt, coming to you then, what was one of your sort of highlights or takeaways from this then?
Getting to know the old story, because we had in America, we have VH1, and in the late 90s, they did a ton of these shows, hour-long shows called Behind the Music, right? And they did one on Def Leppard at the time. And then I think 10 or 12 years later, they did one called, you know, Behind the Music Remastered, where basically they keep the first 40 or 45 minutes or so, and then they give an update. Like, okay, well, what have they been doing since 1998 or whenever we filmed this originally? And then they can walk through stuff like Euphoria and X and, you know, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. So it was good for me to kind of hear more of the what happened here in the beginning. And Jeff Barton is a very interesting character in their history to me. I didn't know who he was. I didn't get Sounds Magazine, wasn't familiar with him. But basically, Jeff Barton was like a head rock writer there. He kind of helped break them and get them signed. But once they moved to Q Prime and they did the Hello America single, it's like he felt they turned on him. And I just, all of a sudden, I saw him in this totally different light. Like, first of all, he's a twerp. You know, he's this guy with glasses. He's this nerdy little dude.
Hey,
yeah, you're good at
Hold
writing
on.
Words. Not, like you, Jackson.
Oh, thank you.
But, you know, well, I'm not afraid to wear glasses myself, right? But no, he's a twerp, you know, and maybe he's good with words. I'm glad you like rock music and everything, guy. But he's like a jock sniffer. He likes to be around them. And they realize, oh, they weren't really my friends? Oh, well, then he trashes them. And after they do a tour of America, they come back to the Reading Festival. And they kind of get pelted. They're treated worse than bad news up there, right? You know, and it's kind of his fault. And I feel like that kind of led to the whole, they're not nearly as popular here in their home country as they are in America. I feel like the Britons kind of took that. I was like, yeah, why do you want to be popular in the colonies? Aren't we good enough for you? Yeah. But it's you can do both. You know, plenty of bands are popular both places. But, I mean, they got two diamond records in America. Two. The other rock bands that have two diamond records, it's like you have to be Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, the Eagles, you know, Van Halen. And the Eagles has a greatest hits album as one of them. So, I mean, it's very rare air to have the double diamond. But over here, it's like they can't get arrested sometimes. It's just kind of sad. And I feel like his role in that is bigger than anybody understands back home.
That was awfully bitchy. The whole deal about how he felt slighted, even though, I mean, what do you want me to say? They got big. I mean, that's what they wanted to do. And then he kind of made it feel like he felt bad about it in 1989. But yeah, he really did a hatchet job on them, and for no apparent reason other than the fact that his feelings got hurt.
All of that very much is exactly how now and historically the British press have always acted, whether it be normal, like, you know, your normal news, whether it be your broadsheets, whether it be your tabloids, whether it be your music press. There's always been a culture in Britain, I don't know if it's like this in America, of the build people up, knock them down. It's like, you know, not wanting to let people get above their station and then like knocking them back down again. It's a very different attitude towards success to what you have in the States, where I think in Britain, the underdog would be favored, or the heroic failure would be given more respect than the person who's like really successful. And that's what's really good in this documentary, is you see that those early stages of their career where they're just surrounded by all of these quite sort of small, petty men, mm-hmm. and that they manage to escape themselves.
Yeah.
So whether it be the two managers, Pete Martin is the first person who gets involved with the band because he owns this Revolution Records where Joe goes to get his records. And, you know, he puts the first EP there and he says, oh, I'll manage you. And then he tells his mate, who's an A&R guy, who's Frank Stewart Brown. He passes the record to him. And then you can just see how petty they are, because Frank Stewart Brown then says to Pete Martin, and this is in the documentary, he says, oh, can I get in touch with them? Can I have their address? And Pete Martin turns around and says, no, you can't. No. I won't share the details. And he says, yeah, I don't think you're good enough to do this. We'll do it together. So right from that very, very first interaction, they're already bickering and squabbling. And like you said, Mac, it's all very, you know, like lower league stuff. And then obviously you've got Jeff Barton, who you know, does what he does. He does, to be fair though, I think their relationship with him now is pretty much mended, because if you, like, you know, they've got like box sets and things like I've got behind me here, and mm-hmm. you know, if you read like magazines and like classic rock and all of this sort of stuff, you'll find that Jeff Barton still writes things for them that are in like official merchandise and official products. I don't think that was the end of their relationship. And in that documentary, he does say, doesn't he, that he feels like he felt a little bit guilty as mm-hmm. he saw them get bottled at the Reading Festivals. Time is a great healer and all of that. And like, and maybe Def Leppard have grown to know, like, you know, this is just part of the business and what people do. And maybe it wasn't personal, or maybe it was, but they definitely sort of still seem to have some sort of professional relationship where essentially they use each other. I'm going to stop talking about Def Leppard at this point. What I want to do is, before we carry on talking about this documentary, I want to talk about my favorite podcast, not Def Leppard, the Ugly American Werewolf in London podcast. We got to know each other through your podcast. I was on it, been on it a couple of times. You don't have to talk about the times I was on it, but for the people who are listening, could you just give us a little bit of a sense of, like, you know, how you started a podcast, what it's about?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, you know, it basically it was born out of lockdown. Once COVID hit and all of a sudden I was over here, I hadn't been over here quite a year yet. And all of a sudden, all the reasons you move from the Midwest of America to England for several years, we get to travel, we get to go to concerts and museums and restaurants and meet people. And, you know, all of that's all shut down. And suddenly you're in a place like 30% the size of the place you were in back home, and you have no friends and family around. So I start Zooming with people back home. And one of them, of course, is Jackson. And Jackson and I would do about 5 minutes of, are you okay? Your parents okay? Getting food to the house? How's the homeschooling thing going? And then it was an hour of, Mac, when was the last time you listened to Fair Warning by Van Halen? You know, Jackson, have you ever heard Sailing England by the Pound? So we started to give each other like homework assignments. Okay, next week, the next week of lockdown, we'll come back and we'll talk about this. And then we realized, well, this is the show. Because before I came, I kind of wanted to do a show, and I came up with a name before I moved. But I'm like, what am I going to talk about? Hey, the dollar grew in value against the pound today. I'm going to transfer some money over and buy. You know, who cares? But this is something Jackson and I can do and basically have done for decades. We've got 1,000 shows in us anyway. So that's what it's grown out of. And it's been a ton of fun, not just for us to do this all the time, but to connect with other members of the rock community like you, you know, like Chris from Rock These Tweets, you know, like folks who love music, and maybe we start talking about it. I'm like, honey, did you know that in 1981, Def Leppard, and she goes, oh, he's doing it again. You know, he's talking about some band I do not care about, or I start to roll back, you know. But to find our people who want to talk about this minutia and all these little things, that's been the most fun for me. I think for Jackson, it's the same.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. Just to kind of reconnect, to meet interesting people who are, I mean, like-minded is a weird phrase to use, but like have the same experiences, even though you grew up, Neil, you know, on the other side of the pond from us, we share a lot of the same likes, a lot of the same takes on this music. Yeah. So meeting cool people and then going back and listening to these records more with a critical eye, where you think, oh, you know what? I never heard that before. I never thought about that. And so really just kind of reconnecting with the music that we grew up with and really love.
Have you discussed any bands or any particular albums where, haven't had that discussion or haven't prepared for that episode of your podcast, it's changed how you thought of that album of that or that band?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, first, certainly like the first 20 or 25 shows, we wanted to do stuff that we kind of knew back and forth. So not because we didn't want to do research for it, but because we wanted to make sure that when we're talking about a song, it's something we're pretty familiar with. But then as you move along, you have to start to go and do more research into things. And sometimes we did an artist, Paul Rodgers. I'm like, well, I know Paul Rodgers. I know Free. I know Bad Company. I know The Firm. But like, do you know how it all fits together? You know, and what has he been doing since all that? So, yeah, you can certainly get a better appreciation, especially when we start to learn the UK side of it. Right, because that's something we're not familiar with. And well, God, it was top of the charts over here, but back in the U.S., they did nothing. You know, a band I just saw live that was just a last week's episode, Simple Minds, great example. Right, one huge hit in America, dozens of hits over here. So when I go to the show, I'm like, all these songs are great. Why aren't they all hits in America? You know, and then I go back and research all their records and their lineups. I'm like, this is an amazing band. More people need to know about them.
And for me, the one, it had to be Genesis, Selling England by the Pound. I mean, I was familiar with Genesis. I mean, I grew up with the, you know, the Genesis record and then on to Invisible Touch in 87 and knew Peter Gabriel, but wasn't really super familiar with the back catalog. So Mac wanted to do Selling England by the Pound. All right, cool. I listened to that basically for the first time and was just like, whoa, what is this? I really missed out on this so far because it's a great record. The band is a lot more than the 80s stuff that they put out. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just totally almost a different vibe and a different feel. So stuff like that where you're kind of rediscovering or getting into something new that somebody just recommends to you is the really the fun part of this.
So at the time of recording now, how many episodes have you got? You've got a lot, because you pretty much do one every single week, don't you? Which I have no idea how you have the stamina to do that. So, I mean, absolute massive credit. So what episode are we up to now?
So out today is episode number 74, where I review Sting live at the Palladium, which I saw last week, and Gary Action reviews The Cult, his very favorite band, from the House of Blues in Orlando. You know, we're so psyched to have live music back. We kind of wanted to space out. We'll do maybe one live show a month or something like that. But now they're just being rescheduled and they're all kind of falling all at once, you know. So we're going to do about four live shows out of like 5 or 6 weeks here. But hey, that's great. I'm just glad to be able to see it again. And I know I'm not the only one.
Of those 70 or so then episodes, you've got a window now to make some recommendations to the people who are listening. And you know what, Def Leppard fans, they're more eclectic than you think. You know, it's, you don't have to think, oh, we did a Bon Jovi episode or we did an Extreme episode. But just in terms of where you think you really hit your form, it was a really good discussion. What are some of the highlights of the episodes that you've done so far or the discussions that you've had so far?
Well, I really think that we kind of hit on something with doing like album reviews. So I think that kind of helps us focus. And I think it also helps us really take a deep dive into them. I know one of the ones that I really enjoyed was our REM document discussion. Again, that was one that I was more familiar than I thought I was going back through it. But we talked to a friend of Max that was really more... he was a little bit older than we were. So to kind of get his perspective on it was really fun and kind of get different takes on it and really explore that album in depth was fun.
For Def Leppard fans who like hard rock, you're going to find a lot of, you know, episodes that'll match up with you. We had Chris from Rock These Tweets do Appetite for Destruction with us. You know, people are going to like that because they've heard him on your show and they have a similar perspective. But honestly, I thought we hit a really good stride with a one we did a couple months ago on Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers for Long After Dark. It's not one of their biggest albums. You know, it's not Full Moon Fever. It's not one of the huge ones. It's not the first album or whatever. It had, you know, one kind of minor hit on it with You Got Lucky, even though I love that song. But the album's great. Like, Jimmy Iovine produced. It kind of came out squished after another album, Hard Promises, and before they did Southern Accents, which had the big Dave Stewart, Don't Come Around Here No More, and the video and all that. So I'm like, this is an album I wouldn't even say rediscovered, just kind of discovered it. Like, I knew a couple songs, but didn't know the whole thing front to back. It was having its 40th anniversary. I'm like, well, let's do this, Jackson. I'm like, damn, this is good. This is really good stuff. And that's what I like is to look, if we do a Led Zeppelin 4 review, you know, that's great and all, but who cares? You know, even if we help them sell 10 copies, great. Now it's 60 million and 10 copies. What's it matter? Everyone knows Led Zeppelin 4. But whether it's having an artist that we want you to know more about, like an Amanda Lehman on the show, or yeah, you know Tom Petty, you know Full Moon Feeder, but do you know Long After Dark? Listen to this. We think you will. And that's been a lot of fun for us for sure.
That's kind of some of the problem too, is that if you don't push yourself, you're going to end up listening to the same thing over and over and over again, because that's your comfort zone. And so you might not love everything, but if you give the other artists and other albums a chance, you're going to find stuff that you like.
And that's what your podcast totally does, because I've gone down the Genesis rabbit hole based on the back of listening to you guys talking so enthusiastically about Genesis and Steve Hackett. And I've found loads of stuff that, I mean, I'm not a fan of all of it, but within albums, I'm finding like four or five songs each time that I really, really love. I mean, obviously, you cover a wide range of things. It's a little bit like the podcast version of, you know, when you go to the cinema and you have to pick and mix and, you know, you get your carton or your bag and you can go and pick some of those sweets and some of those sweets and some of those sweets. And you end up with a real wild variety of things that might not be healthy for you, but is really, really enjoyable. Your podcast is healthy as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to neatly segue back to Def Leppard now. You mentioned Tom Petty in the recent Volume 3 box set. that Def Leppard released, they actually covered a Def Leppard, a Tom Petty song, American Girl.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a Def Leppard link between what you were just saying and Def Leppard. They then did a documentary in 1989, which just happens to be what we're talking about now. And in that documentary, we get to see Rick Allen got returned to the place where he had his accident and he lost his arm. Pretty harrowing stuff. That. What was your take on that part of the documentary?
I didn't like it. I really didn't, you know, because like when the VH1 did their Behind the Music, they had like the old lady and the retired cop, like who lived by and came to the scene. They brought them back out, and to bring him back out there, you could tell he was shaky. Like, oh, this is kind of weird being back. And when they showed the photos, I feel like they had like big boulders and rocks on the side of the road, which is really not uncommon for England or Ireland, for that matter, to have road, to have 2 inches of grass, and then to have a really old stone wall or a bunch of boulders that if you run into, you're going to be in trouble. And I think maybe they were kind of gone. They put up more of a link fence or a chain fence or something like that. But I was just like, why would they do this to him? This just doesn't seem right. And then you see him break down. Was that his dad who came over and hugged him?
It's the director.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I thought it was unnecessary.
And I would say the same thing, because you could tell right off the bat when he crosses over into the field, he's like, this is kind of strange. You can already tell this is weird. This is weird. This is not going to work. We shouldn't have done this. And then, like Mac was saying, he breaks down. It's brutal to watch. It is brutal to watch him do that.
And what did you expect from the guy? I mean, what was the point?
It's one of those things, isn't it, as well, where obviously this day and age, people are much more aware of things like PTSD. And obviously Rick Allen since has been diagnosed with that. And as a consequence of being diagnosed with that, you know, he does a lot of charity work for veterans and soldiers in the States in particular. And when you watch it, because I watch this whole thing and I made a load of notes and everything. And it's heartbreaking to watch, because you can see him trying to employ some sort of gallows humor and make light of this, of the fact that he's lost his arm, which is sort of what people do. The stories, isn't there, in the First World War, people in the trenches, making jokes and whatever. It's the way you deal with disasters and things. It's just dead interesting, the language he uses. He said, and I ended up breaking my car in a big way. And he tries to make a little joke of it. And then when you see him in the field where, he ends up, he says, God, this place is bleak. I've got the strangest feeling in my stomach. And then he makes a little joke. He goes, I hate that corner. You can see him literally battling with himself, trying to hold his emotions back by, make these little jokes. And then it's when he says this where, you can see it clicks in his head. He's looking around and he says, I'm surprised I didn't hurt myself more than I did. I'm lost for words. And then at that point, that's when he turns away from the camera. And obviously he sort of starts crying and everything.
And they showed pictures of the car. They cut away to the pictures of the car. He's alive. There's no earthly reason why he's alive, looking at the way that car ended up. I mean, it was just destroyed.
And he was still so young then. I mean, you think, okay, well, he had the accident. Mm-hmm. He's grown up. He started to drum again. They have a new record. He's great. He's still like 25, 26 years old at the time of this, right? And he never did anything else. It's like they talk about, Steve Clark was a lathe operator. Rick Allen was in school. This is the only job he's ever had. He's never done anything else. So he's, I'm not going to say he's immature, because he's probably much more mature after going through all those different things. But at that age, it's still tough to process this. Maybe you bring him back there today to put some closure in it, now that he's, in his 50s or early 60s. But back then, that was beyond the pale for me. That kind of upset me.
One thing it does do, the one silver lining out of it, is that it does show you the reality and the absolute tragedy of what happened and how difficult it is for Rick Allen, because I think we're probably all just sort of used to going, Def Leppard, they're the drummer with one arm. There's some shit band a few years ago, I can't remember, where if part of the chorus is actually the Def Leppard for drummer, it's got the drummer from Def Leppard's only got one arm. I can't remember who the band is, but it's definitely out there. So it's just a little bit of a acceptance that the drummer out of Def Leppard has one arm, and he lost his arm, and then he learned how to play the drums again, and then he just got on with it. Anyone who actually looks what happens in like the sort of couple of decades afterwards can see that, you know, it still impacts. And if you watch him today on, he was on a program in the States, and he was talking about it, and he got upset again. So it's not something that you just get over. Mm-hmm. And it happens once you learn to play the drums, and that was something that happened 30 years ago. I suppose the one thing this documentary does do, even though it's horrible to see and maybe not ethically good what they did, is at least you can see, do you know what? It's a big fucking deal what he's gone through, and it's not just something where you write it on a piece of paper, he's got one arm and that's it. It's like a real human at the end of this.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that it was kind of real in passing, but it struck me. He said when he got out of bed for the first time and he lurched to one side, he's like, you don't realize how your balance is off. Yeah, it's just gone. So yeah, to your point, all of these years, it's such a great story. Like, yeah, you know, he came back, you know, he's back in the band, the Thunder God returns. But yeah, that's a really heavy duty thing to just say, okay, you're good, right? No, I'm not good. I still have a lot of regret. I still have a lot of fear. And thank God that his girlfriend at the time was not killed, because I think if she had died in that, he'd have never gotten over that. I know I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point.
And he says it in the documentary as well, that it was the fact that he never lost consciousness that they reckon is what kept him alive. Because when he's approached by, like, there's a policeman and a nurse who turn up, the first thing that he says as he's standing there with one arm missing is, I'm a drummer in a famous rock band. He's clearly like an absolute shock, but that's like the first thing that like comes to mind. And it's just such a surreal thing to imagine actually happening. So that's obviously in the story of Def Leppard at this point in 1989. So this precedes, you know, what happens with Steve Clark afterwards. That's the, you know, the big tragedy that occurs. Outside of that, then, was there anything else, any other highlights or any other takeaways or bits that sort of stuck out for you in this documentary?
Well, one of them for me was when they were talking about bringing in Phil Collin, and he goes into the studio, he's playing Stand Up, Kick Love into Motion. Mm-hmm. So that's off Adrenalize. So they're already working on the next record. And the fact, and I didn't catch that the first time, like, cause I was listening to what he was saying. I wasn't really listening to what he was playing at that point. And so you've got that coupled with the stuff from Steve Clark. That just, I'm like, oh, he's not, I know what's going to happen to him at that point in time. Everything's cool. They're working on a new record.
Right.
They've got the Rick Allen thing behind them. He's back in the band. Smooth sailing. No, sir. We are heading for another cliff and you don't even know it yet.
Yeah. That's sad. And so two things for me. Yeah. That, like, when you see Steve at the end saying, yeah, it's hard to sell 12 million records and not have a little bit of money. But it creates problems, right? Because if you go to the pub and you buy everybody around, you're the rich guy showing off. But if you just buy yourself, you're the stingy bastard who made it big and won't, you know, help his buddies out. So it's like he had these demons to fight no matter what. And in the VH1 documentary, Mick Wall's like, he's the unhappiest rock star millionaire I have ever met in my life. It just didn't make any sense. But on the fun side of things for this documentary, what the fuck were they doing in Alvarado, Texas, man? Like, I get they go to New York to see, you know, Q Prime, Peter, and see them. They go to Portland to see Gloria, the first DJ that ever played them on the radio. I'm like, that's cool. And then they went to Texas to talk to this guy, Redbeard, who I guess is a big DJ or whatever. But even that was weird. It's like they're in some random restaurant during lunch. It's like, hey, that's Def Leppard, and they've got a bunch of songs we can play for you. And then they interviewed him like, yeah, they had 10 great songs we could play on the radio. But before that, they cut to this like dirt road in the middle of nowhere, Texas, to this, you know, dive bar. And these randos talking about how they like Def Leppard, or the girls think they're good looking and the guy thinks he's got good guitars. I'm like, how did the BBC even find Alvarado, Texas? Jackson, you lived in Texas for 20 years. You know where Alvarado is?
Only because I looked it up, because I said the same thing. Where in the hell is Alvarado? And I look on a map. It's like it's south east of Fort Worth. I'm like, well, all right. I mean, I guess maybe I've been through there on the way to Dallas, but yeah, that was awfully random. But you know, the one guy, the guy with the kind of, he wasn't a teenager. He was a little bit old. He had a pretty good take. I mean, he was he was eloquent, of course, you know, the little kid was, they were all had some pretty good takes. Oh, Joe Elliott, he's so attractive. All right, take it easy, honey. All right. I'm sure he's looking to pick you up in the cafe there. Yeah, that was a little strange. And the other thing too, you were talking about Redbeard. I mean, unfortunately, you want to talk about a guy who was a face for radio. Like, he's got that voice. You know, here we're back with Def Leppard off. And you look like, oh, okay. But, you know, the other thing that he said, too, was when he got that record, he looked at it and he was like, we're going to play 10 out of the 12 songs. Mm-hmm. This thing is a monster.
I think maybe they put that bit in because it's obviously made for a British audience. And
you're thinking, oh, that's what the United States is like. Alvarado, Texas, just spoke for the entire country. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the BBC have thought to themselves, right? We need to show the bit where they become really big in America. So therefore, let's take every sort of stereotype we think of America in the 1980s, and let's just find like somewhere that's the exact opposite of Britain. So they're in the middle of a desert. There's like, you know, like the dirt road, the pickup truck, the little diner thing that looks like there's nothing around for like, you know, 100 miles,
right?
Which, you know, there probably like isn't.
It looks like a hitchhiker film or something like that. And then you've got like these, like, and then it's good as well because you go from Britain where we're all like pasty white and we've all got bad teeth and everything. And then you've got all of these lovely tanned people in this diner and everything. And they're all just like super American. And it's like, I remember watching that thinking, I'd love to go to that diner and speak to those, all of those Def Leppard fans. I could really get on them.
Speaking of that part, how much, and I was thinking about you when I watched it again, when the lady, what was her name? Paula, DJ. When she holds up that pressing that's signed, I'm thinking, Neil, you would crawl over a couple of people to get your hands on that thing.
Oh, yeah. No problem at all. I've got one final question for you, Dan, which is, when I asked the two of you to take an hour out of your lives to watch some old documentary, rubbish footage on some random YouTube channel, and you kindly did it for me, was that an hour of your life that was spent well? Or are you now thinking, what was all of the fuss about? Obviously, it's no 9-hour Get Back Beatles epic. Was it something worth watching?
Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about it. Look, I'm a sucker for a good documentary, especially a rock and roll band documentary. And then it's a band that I really like. Then that's a no-brainer. And at first, because here's the thing, so just watch it and let me know. Well, at this point, I've watched it like 5 times, Bud, because, you know, we were going to do it once, and then, you know, you got sick, we had to reschedule, and then I forgot about it, so I had to watch it again, and then I had to make my notes. So I've watched it several times. It's not the definitive, for me, Def Leppard documentary, because it stops in 1989, and too much happened after that to not be included in it. But no, it was great to kind of see more in depth their origins and see Pete and Andy Peebles and, you know, all these people who I had no clue who they were. Who is Jeff Barton? Okay, well, now I know. And to see him go back there, see him in the pub doing that. I'd seen bits and clips of it before, but to see it all, hey, I appreciate it, man. I'm up for any good documentary. And on the one on Def Leppard, good stuff.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. If they made this same thing today, they probably would have, just for the sake of time, not included a lot of the stuff from the beginning. And that's really the interesting part to me, is how did these guys, these kids from Sheffield, England, make a one in a zillion shot to become this giant rock band? Yeah, there were good times, there were bad times, pitfalls, and just to see that, yeah, it was pretty interesting. Even though, like you said, it was a dodgy copy on YouTube.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is where its merits are, is in terms of that early insight that you get, that, you know, you don't get in, you know, like a Metal Hammer magazine or a Kerrang! Magazine or a Rolling Stone. I think it is that detail which I've taken a lot of from my own podcast. And, you know, anyone who watches this and then listens back to previous episodes, you will blatantly see where I've found certain bits of information from. And also there's those rare things that you don't get to see that often. Interviews with Pete Willis, interviews with Rutt Lang, even mm-hmm. Steve Clark to a certain extent. Right then, before we go, where can everyone go and find the Ugly American Werewolf in London podcast?
Well, you can download and subscribe most anywhere you get your podcasts. But we have, since last time we spoke, we've been picked up by the Pantheon Podcast Network, which is kind of a family of about 100 different music podcasts, not very far from all rock and roll, but some of our favorite podcasts that we listen to were on there, so we're proud to be a part of that. You can see it at pantheonpodcast.com, or sorry, at pantheonpods or pantheonpodcast.com. And we are at ugly underscore werewolf on Twitter, or at ActionJax, JAX72. Anything else, Jackson? Am I forgetting something?
That's it. You've got it. Come check us out.
Also, as well, for anyone listening, I'll have put links to all of everything that Mac and Jackson have just said. So you'll be able to click on those links in the show notes of this podcast and take you straight there as well. So you can get there as quickly and as easily as possible and start listening as soon as possible. And there's no need to come back to thank me for introducing you to this excellent podcast they've got. So, gentlemen, thank you very, very much for giving up your time today. I know as well, Jackson, it's like 7:30. Or when we started, it was 7:30 in the morning there for you. So very, very early. You've done really well keeping your eyes open.
Thank you.
I'm very impressed. And I'm hoping you can go back to bed now, but you might have a full day of work ahead of you.
Yeah, no, now it's time to get busy in the real world. But no, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.